If you open your phone right now or step into an office or, I mean, even just sit down at a local coffee shop, you feel it immediately, don't
Yeah,
you?
it is palpable. It's just everywhere.
Right. It's this relentless, almost suffocating pressure to just hustle, like to build your own empire and be the undisputed owner of this massive success story.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very specific modern kind of exhaustion. We just have this constant low-level anxiety humming in the background at all times.
Yeah, and I know so many of you, our beloved family members out there listening, are deeply feeling that burnout right now. Just that heavy weight.
It's that voice always asking, am I doing enough? Am I climbing the ladder fast enough?
Totally.
Yeah.
Because we desperately want to categorize our life into clear buckets of like success or failure.
Right, because psychologically, that gives us this false sense of control over a completely unpredictable world.
And it is absolutely exhausting to constantly play that game. So for our exploration today, we are going to look at a radical way to navigate that overwhelming pressure.
I'm really looking forward to this one, actually.
Me too. We are drawing some really incredible insights from a fascinating sermon message today. It focuses on the Apostle Paul's ancient letter to the church in Corinth.
Which is such a rich text.
It really is. Specifically, this sermon message unpacks one incredibly loaded line from 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 9. But what if the cure to all this burnout isn't trying to just rest more, but completely changing your job title?
That is the defining tension right there. But to really get to the bottom of this, I mean, we have to remember that letters always have a purpose.
Right.
Nobody just writes a letter into a total void.
Right, there's always a reason.
Exactly. Sometimes they are written to show deep affection, sure, but other times they are urgently fired off to fix a crumbling relationship or to correct a dangerous trajectory.
Like an intervention.
Precisely like an intervention. So our mission today is to read between the lines of Paul's letter. We want to discover the heart behind those words,
And understand exactly how an ancient message delivered to a bustling port city applies directly to the modern burnout we are all experiencing. Because you can't just drop an ancient quote on a modern problem without understanding the backdrop, right?
No, you really can't. Context is everything.
So before we look at Paul's specific instructions, we need to understand the environment these Corinthians were swimming in. Like, what made their city so toxic that it required this emergency intervention in the first place?
Well, it is entirely about the geography and the economics of the place.
Okay, lay it out for us.
So I think we often have this tendency to imagine biblical cities as these quiet, dusty, purely religious towns where everyone just sat around debating philosophy all day.
Yeah, like everyone is just wearing robes and staring at the sky.
Right. But Corinth was the exact opposite of that. I mean, it was a boom town.
A boomtown.
Yeah, it was located on this narrow strip of land, an isthmus connecting two major bodies of water, right near Athens.
Okay, so a major transit hub.
Huge. Rather than sailing all the way around the incredibly dangerous southern coast of Greece, merchants would dock at Corinth. And then slaves would literally drag the massive cargo ships overland across a paved trackway to the other side.
Wait, they dragged entire ships across the land.
Literally dragged them.
Wow. So it was essentially the ancient equivalent of like the Panama Canal.
That is a perfect comparison.
The
Yes.
sheer volume of traffic and commerce going through there must have been absolutely staggering.
Staggering is definitely the right word. I mean, because of that constant massive need for heavy labor and the endless flow of global trade, it created this explosive economic boom.
So everyone wanted a piece of the pie.
Exactly. People from all over the known world were moving there. They were going to find work, start businesses, make their fortunes.
Just chasing the gold rush.
Yeah, it was a chaotic melting pot of different languages, highly developed culture, and just a massive influx of wealth.
That sounds exactly like looking at Wall Street in the 1980s, or, Silicon Valley over the last decade.
Oh, 100%.
It's a place where hustle culture isn't just a fun trend on social media. It is the ultimate religion of the city. Like, it's the air everyone breathes.
Right. And in environments like that, there is this biological fear of scarcity driving everything you do.
Because if you aren't winning, you're losing.
Exactly. You get a dopamine hit every time you climb over someone else to reach the next rung on the ladder.
Which brings up a really crucial conflict for our discussion today. In a city where the entire societal infrastructure is built on upward mobility, making a quick buck, and ruthless competition, how do you survive?
And that's exactly what the sermon message points out. The early Christian church in Corinth was uniquely vulnerable to this exact environment.
So, If they are drowning in this toxic hustle culture, what does an intervention even look like? I mean, you can't just tell a type A Corinthian trader to, like, relax and take a deep breath.
No, that wouldn't work at all.
Did they just try to hide from the city? Like form a commune or something?
Yeah, and actually that was the core problem. They weren't hiding from it. They were being completely swallowed up by it.
Really?
Yeah, they weren't fighting the hustle culture. They were bringing it directly into their congregation.
Oh, wow. So they were hustling each other.
Basically, yeah. They were forming factions, bragging about their spiritual status, and trying to rank themselves just like they did out in the marketplace.
That sounds exhausting.
It was. The congregation was actively collapsing under the sheer weight of secularism. They were adopting the cutthroat behaviors of the city around them, and it was tearing their entire community apart.
Okay, well, that perfectly explains why Paul couldn't just send a polite, friendly greeting. He had to completely shatter their worldview.
He really had to take a sledgehammer to it.
Right. And to snap them out of this relentless pursuit of selfish ambition, he gives them a radical new identity. He literally changes their job description by calling them God's co-workers.
It's such a brilliant linguistic and psychological pivot on his part.
How so?
Well, he shifts their entire perspective from what they're trying to achieve for themselves, you know, to who they are in relation to the Creator.
And the sermon message makes a really important distinction about this exact phrase.
Mm-hmm.
Being God's co-workers doesn't mean doing the work instead of God.
Right.
Like, it's not as if the Creator has stepped away and handed us the keys to run the universe on our own.
No, not at all.
It means working in step with Him. It's this glorious invitation to join a cosmic dream, not just a frantic hired gig to pay the bills.
Just think about the physiological relief of that shift for a second.
It would be massive.
Right. When you view yourself as the sole owner of your destiny, your cortisol levels are constantly spiking. The entire weight of your universe rests squarely on your shoulders.
Because if you fail, the empire crumbles.
Exactly. But a coworker isn't carrying the ultimate burden of the company's survival. The pressure is off.
But wait, I do have to push back on this terminology for just a second.
Okay, sure.
Because calling ourselves coworkers almost sounds like a partnership of equals. Doesn't that risk making humans a bit arrogant?
I can see why you'd say that, yeah.
Especially in a city like Corinth that is already utterly obsessed with status and self-importance. Like, if I'm a Corinthian who loves bragging about my wealth, hearing I'm God's co-worker might just inflate my ego even more. Look at me, I'm partnering with the divine.
That danger is exactly why Paul structures his argument the way he does, and it's a nuance the sermon message heavily emphasizes.
Okay, what's the caveat?
The crucial caveat is that this title of co-worker is absolutely not earned by human merit. It is not a promotion you get because you hustled the hardest, closed the biggest deal, or achieved the highest social standing in Corinth.
So it's not a meritocracy?
No.
Yeah.
It is a holy calling initiated entirely by the Creator.
So it's less like two CEOs signing a corporate merger,
mm-hmm.
and more like a master maestro inviting a novice musician to sit in the orchestra.
Yes. That's a great way to look at it.
The prestige comes entirely from the one who invited you, not from your own resume.
And that maestro analogy is perfect because the non-negotiable requirement for sitting in that orchestra is absolute obedience to the conductor.
You have to follow their lead.
Right. You cannot have a partnership of equals where you have your own separate agenda. True co-workers must align their personal goals entirely with the overarching vision.
Meaning you have to actually abandon your own worldly ambitions. Like if you were sitting in the orchestra, you can't just start playing a totally different song because you think it will make you look better to the audience.
Precisely. In a secular culture, your goal is to build your own kingdom and your own brand. But as a coworker in this context, your goal is to build something far larger than yourself.
You're part of a bigger symphony.
Exactly. You take your cues directly from the leader, moving at their pace. If your vision doesn't match the vision of the one who called you, you aren't truly acting as a coworker.
You're just a rogue employee.
You're a rogue employee trying to hijack the operation.
And that idea of hijacking the operation leads perfectly into the next metaphors Paul uses. Once he establishes that they are coworkers, he systematically dismantles their obsession with ownership.
He really goes after it.
He does. He calls them God's field and God's building.
Notice how the imagery shifts entirely to the concept of property lines here.
What do you mean?
Well, a field doesn't own itself. A building doesn't hold its own deed. They belong to the one who purchased the land and built the structure.
Oh, I see.
By using these specific terms, Paul is reminding them that everything, their wealth, their talents, their very lives, belongs to the Creator. The ultimate property line has been drawn, and humans are not on the side of the owner.
Which hits right at the core of human psychology. Because we inherently crave ownership, don't we?
Oh, absolutely.
We want our names on the deed. We want our names on the corner office. We want the legacy. It gives us this illusion of permanence.
It's all about control.
Right. But the worldly temptation, both in ancient Corinth and in our modern hustle culture today, is to constantly try to usurp that owner's seat.
We desperately want to be the landlord. But the Surin message makes it clear that our actual role is to be stewards or managers.
Stewards. That's a very different mindset.
Totally different. And this isn't a new concept Paul is inventing either. The message traces this all the way back to the book of Genesis. When humanity was first placed in the garden, the explicit command was to work and keep the land.
Work and keep it. Not to, like, extract every ounce of value for personal gain and then sell it off to the highest bidder.
Right. Stewardship implies a deep level of care and responsibility, but it completely removes the authority to do whatever you want with the resources. You are managing the property on behalf of someone else.
Okay, let's put some flesh on the bones of this idea, because the friction here is really fascinating to me.
Sure, let's explore it.
It's kind of like being handed the keys to a breathtaking multi-million dollar estate.
Yeah.
The owner says, I want you to house sit for me.
Okay, I like this.
So you get to live there, you get to enjoy the beautiful gardens, you care for the property, and you help it thrive. But the second you start holding a yard sale to sell off the antique furniture, or you march down to the county clerk trying to put your own name on the deed,
you're in huge trouble.
Yeah. You've fundamentally misunderstood your role.
And that friction you're describing is the everyday reality of living in a secular world. You are enjoying the benefits of the estate, but your authority is completely derived from the true owner.
You aren't the boss.
No. A steward never makes decisions based on their own personal greed or their own fear of scarcity. Everything is about the owner's intent.
Let's apply this to a modern workplace then. Think about a regional sales manager listening to this right now. If they're operating under the hustle culture of Corinth, they might undercut their peers, hoard the best leads for themselves, and take all the credit just to ensure they get the year-end bonus.
Because they view their career as their own property to exploit.
Exactly. But if that same sales manager shifts their identity to being a steward of God's field, their entire methodology changes, doesn't it?
Completely changes. They still work hard, perhaps even harder, actually, because they are honoring a holy calling, but they no longer operate from a place of ruthless extraction.
So how does that look practically?
Well, they mentor their junior team members. They operate with total honesty on their contracts. They don't have to crush the competition to feel secure because their ultimate security isn't tied to their quarterly earnings.
It's tied to their obedience to the owner.
Exactly.
The biological relief of that is just huge. You can sleep soundly knowing the ultimate outcome of the universe, or, you know, even just the company, isn't your problem to solve.
Your only job is faithful management.
But that brings us to the hardest part of our discussion today. How do we practically do this when we are surrounded by a society that is constantly screaming at us to conquer and consume?
It's the million-dollar question.
Right. How do you live as a faithful house sitter in a world completely run by aggressive real estate developers?
Well, the sermon message offers a brilliant linguistic insight that answers exactly how we are supposed to interact with the world around us.
I love linguistic connections. What is it?
It points out that the English word for cultivate, as in to cultivate a field, shares the exact same root as the word culture.
Wait, really? Cultivate and culture share the same root?
They do.
I mean, I've never actually put that together before.
It's a profound connection when you really think about it. Culture is not just some abstract sociological concept. It is the direct byproduct of what we cultivate in our daily lives.
That means every small action is literally a localized culture shift.
Precisely.
So if culture is just what grows from what we cultivate, then simply doing my daily work with integrity isn't just a personal, private, moral victory.
No, it has a ripple effect.
Every time we choose to encourage a coworker instead of, you know, throwing them under the bus to get ahead, we are actively growing a new culture.
Yes, we are taking the soil of our daily lives and planting something completely alien to the secular world.
That is so powerful.
And sociologically speaking, this is how macrocultures are actually disrupted. I mean, the Christians in Corinth couldn't just isolate themselves and hide in the mountains.
That wouldn't fix anything.
And they certainly couldn't stage a hostile political takeover of the city.
Right. Both of those extremes fail. Because isolation makes you irrelevant and assimilation makes you toxic.
Exactly. Instead, the sermon message validates that our own lives, our own spheres of influence, are the field.
So we start right where we are.
By recognizing the ultimate ownership over our finances, our relationships, and our careers, and acting as faithful stewards in those specific areas, we actively cultivate a microculture of holiness.
And if you have a city entirely driven by greed and status, and suddenly a group of people start making decisions based on radical generosity, deep humility, and obedience to a higher calling, I mean, that is going to create massive friction.
Oh, it will stand out like a sore thumb.
But it's also incredibly attractive, isn't it? Especially to people who are just burning out on the hustle.
It stands in stark contrast. And slowly, plant by plant, field by field, that is how a success-obsessed, worldly environment is ultimately transformed.
It is the quiet revolution of integrity.
I like that phrase.
It is much less glamorous than a hostile takeover. And it certainly won't get you on the cover of a business magazine, but it is far more enduring.
Without a doubt.
So for all of our beloved family members out there who are struggling with the weight of expectations today, I just want you to think about your own office, your own home, or your own classroom.
It applies everywhere.
It really does. You don't have to conquer your entire industry to find purpose. The overwhelming pressure of our hustle-obsessed culture hasn't actually changed much from ancient Corinth to our modern world.
Human nature is remarkably consistent.
True. But the solution isn't to hustle harder, and it certainly isn't to just throw up your hands, give up, and walk away. The solution is a radical identity shift.
We have to formally resign from the position of owner.
Yes. We resign as owner, and we accept the invitation to be a glorious coworker and a deeply trusted steward.
It takes so much pressure off.
In a world that is constantly pressuring you to chase money, elevate your own status, and sit in that owner's seat, true peace actually comes from stepping down.
Stepping out of the rat race.
It comes from the profound realization that you don't actually have to hold the universe together.
It is the ultimate paradox of stewardship. I mean, by giving up ownership, we actually find our true value and a sustainable rhythm for our lives.
That's beautifully said.
Thank you. And as we wrap up our discussion today, I really want to leave all of our beloved family members with a final thought, just a question for you to really sit with as you navigate your week.
I love these. Let's hear it.
If your daily life, your specific workplace, and your family constitute a field that you are merely managing, what specific culture are you actively cultivating there today?
Wow.
And further, if the true owner walked into your field tomorrow morning, would he recognize the crop as his own?
Would the owner recognize the crop? That is a question that completely changes how I look at my inbox, my meetings, and honestly, my family dinners.
It reframes everything.
What a powerful way to frame our daily choices. To all of our beloved family members, thank you so much for joining us today for this exploration.
It's been a great conversation.
It really has. We hope this has given you some deep relief from the hustle, a completely new perspective on your daily work, and the courage to cultivate something truly beautiful in whatever field you find yourself managing this week. Take care, and we will talk with you next time.